wake up in the morning, I go whoopee. When I go to bed at night, I go whoopee. I say, here comes the colonel. Whoopee, whoopee, whoopee.
Well, I'm glad somebody's saying whoopee, even if the ignorant comedians from down the hall, the auditions for Comedy Central, where we share the studio. Well, welcome back in the second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. We're going to get back with our interview with Mike McNair, Bell Helicopter, talking about flying cars. And then, of course, we're going to hear back again from our good friend, Dr. Dashwin Feng, from Macau in China, giving us lots of insights into China. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. But right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information that we keep here on the set. We have to rummage around in the coin jar just a minute here to get the coins. And then we want to ask the spirit of the fountain for today's query.
Welcome to the Fountain of Useless Information. How can I...
Yes, we have awakened the spirit of the fountain, who knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all. For a price, that's why we had to throw in the coins, of course. All right, oh spirit of the fountain, here is a real stumper for you. And no cheating and running and Googling this. Put on your thinking cap or your shower cap or whatever you have in there in that wet fountain. What day of the week did World War II begin? World War II began on what day of the week, oh spirit of the fountain?
I have given you my answer. Now you may tell me.
The spirit of the fountain knows all, hears all, sees all, and does tell all. The day of the week the World War II began, nobody remembers, but the spirit of the fountain does. It was a Friday. Yeah, for all it's worth, it's a Friday. All right. Enough of frivolity, huh? Let's get back to our program. Okay, so if you were listening in the first half hour, you heard Mike McNair. He's a futurist with Bell Helicopter working on autonomous automobiles, flying cars, going to be introduced to the Dallas-Fort Worth area and in Dubai in a few years, along with Uber. And we were worried about safety. We have solved some of the problems. As you say, air corridors, you know, airplanes flying east and west fly at a certain altitude, and north and south fly at a different altitude, and all sorts of different things. And air traffic with the airliners has got to be pretty safe. And yet, we had an airliner program to fly from, I think it was Indonesia or Malaysia somewhere, into Beijing. And in mid-flight, it does a right-hand turn and ends up someplace in the Indian Ocean. And we still haven't figured out exactly how that happened. And then, of course, we had pain a few years ago where they lost oxygen in the cockpit, the golfer, and the plane just went on and on and on and on, finally landed in Canada someplace. Everybody was dead on board. Are we learning any lessons from these things?
All the time. In fact, all those lessons lead into the safety solution. We want to learn what causes those failures. We want to understand them so that we can mitigate them in any future aircraft.
Okay. So this, you believe sincerely, this is where we're going. You think that these problems that I've been throwing at you, one right after another, are actually going to be overcome, and we're going to be able to have vertical takeoff and landing vehicles. Some of them could be our personal vehicles, and somehow or other they're going to safely be guided through some GPS or other and through the internet, and we're going to overcome all these things, beginning with cybersecurity. Is that the upshot of this?
Yes, that is definitely the challenge, and that is the goal. We will. I'm sure that we will see ourselves step our way to that objective, and it'll be exciting to see those steps unfold, but the objective and the goal is indeed to be able to safely transport people on autonomous vehicles by air.
Okay, all right, so what have we missed? What haven't I asked you? What is a takeaway? What do you want to leave your audience with at Metricon is the real succinct message.
So the presentation that I'm giving is using these air taxis as the case study, if you will. So what I'm wanting to get across, because this is a primarily engineering audience at Metricon, so I want them to understand that this is a multidisciplinary effort. That it's not just a roboticist, it's not just an electrical engineer or an aerospace engineer who's designing these things. That it really calls into play a community of experts in order to make this happen.
So Bell Helicopter and Uber and Hillwood Development, I don't know what part they play in it, I guess, building the physical areas where this traffic's going to take off and land. I don't know how Hillwood got into it, but you're going to be trying to attract as many brains as you can in various different disciplines and areas to all come together. How in the devil are you going to do this?
Well, it's by understanding a couple of things. One is that we're not developing just an air vehicle. That air vehicle exists within an overall framework and infrastructure. And just like the questions that you've asked, it involves legislators. It involves probably some amount of psychologists and sociologists to understand how people respond and think about aircraft. And it's going to engage, of course, a number of engineering disciplines, both traditional disciplines as well as emerging disciplines, something like cybersecurity or big data or machine learning. All these have to come together in order to make this successful.
It sounds gargantuan. It just sounds gargantuan. And it sounds like something that almost is beyond the scope of pulling together, and I would guess that you're probably going to have to call on minds outside of the United States and in other countries and those sorts of things. Are there plans to have some sort of relationship with, say, the European Union or with Russia or with any or China or any of these other entities?
Well, certainly we want to leverage whatever applicable brain power we can bring to the problem. For example, the FAA, they have very good relationships with EASA, who is the European counterpart to the FAA. And I know that there are discussions going on in coordination between those two agencies. It is definitely something that is big in scope. You're exactly spot on with that. It's exciting. It's big. And it's a challenge.
Okay, Mike, before we get out of here, I know that you've been mentored in your career by some brilliant people, and I know that you're mentoring people right now, younger people coming along and maybe family or friends or something like that. Words to live by, kind of a creed of operation, you know, what guides you? Where do you get your beacon?
Interesting question. Good question. You know, I guess I've always been a big fan of, let me back up. I used to be in Boy Scouts. And one of the things that I was taught when you go camping is leave your campsite in the same condition or better than when you found it. You know, I want to do the same thing with the people I interact with and the things that I personally am involved with. I want to make a difference. I want to make sure that there's a benefit.
Okay. All right. Mike McNair, plenary speaker for the October 26th Metricon Conference. It's coming up at the Arlington Convention Center. More on that at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you will see a link. Mike is with Bell Helicopter and the innovation lead for autonomy vehicles at Bell. That is vertical takeoff and landing vehicles being introduced in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and in Dubai in cooperation with Uber. in their Elevate program. Mike, thanks so much for being with us. I can't tell you how enjoyable this was, and certainly we're going to look with awe as you bring us more information on October 26th.
I am looking forward to doing exactly that, and I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Science News Radio Network special presentation, Promise of Tomorrow, with Colonel Mason. Those of you listening on radio can also hear us commercial-free online anytime, webcast, at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Okay, now let's get back to our conversation where we left off last week with our good friend Dr. Dashuan Feng with Macau University in China, giving us the great insights in China at this busy restaurant.
You cannot use 300 years to think of China. You have to use 5,000 years to think of China, which is very tough for Americans to do. Because beyond 300 years, there's nothing here. Okay? And so, in the Ming Dynasty, there was a Muslim in China. His name is Zheng He. Now, he's very interesting. Actually, he has a Muslim name. He was Muslim. And eventually, he became a eunuch in the emperor. You know what a eunuch is?
Yes, a eunuch.
Yes. In other words, he's castrated.
Yes.
And he also became an admiral in the Chinese Navy in those days.
And they needed the eunuch because he wanted to be safe with the women? Was that the thing?
Yeah, that's right. In the emperor. Yeah. Within the emperor confinement. Anyway, and it's a very interesting piece of history because he led an armada, Chinese naval armada, of about 30,000 soldiers, and seven times out of China into Southeast Asia, into Indonesia, into Ceylon. In those days, it was called Ceylon. I think it's called Sri Lanka now. Into India, into Bangladesh, into and because he was Muslim, in fact, he went as far as to Mecca and West Africa. All this well known in history. Yes, any historian would know that. Seven times. And went on peaceful mission, and it's highly documented that the Muslim countries welcomed him enormously. He went on trade missions, very peaceful trade missions. And I thought it's very interesting that there was never a Chinese form of the Chinese East India Company. Not an inch of land was ever became a colony. You know, the idea of a nation in China with boundaries, I learned from my historian friends, is a fairly recent concept. China referred to itself as under the sky, Tianxia.
Yes, but there was the Great Wall of China. They must have figured there was a mark.
The Great Wall of China was built to prevent the yellow hordes from coming in. But it wasn't regarded at the boundary of China. The boundary could be somewhere. Chinese don't think of boundaries. So therefore, during the Qing Dynasty, I was told, when foreign country want a piece of land here, want a piece, China essentially said okay, because they don't understand what it means to be boundaries. This was an entirely a Western concept. So so many, many of these things that I, you know, because I'm educated in the U.S., I thought it is obvious. Once you really learn about China, it's so different. So, for China to think of being a great, you know, for example, China regarded Vietnam for a long time as a country that is friendly to China, and the emperor of the Vietnamese would come to China and give them goods from Vietnam. And you know what happens? When the Vietnamese brought something very nice to give to the emperor is so pleased, what he gave back to the Vietnamese was 10 times more worthy. And then China never made Vietnam a colony. So the colonial concept or wanting a country to take over another country as subservient. China wouldn't mind other people be subservient, but not as a colony.
So global domination by China is probably something that is just totally foreign and in nowhere.
And I think it still is in certain sense. And so, to understand the U.S.-China relationship, this sort of dialogue must happen quickly in the U.S. And this sort of dialogue is good for the U.S. to understand China from a historical point of view. And U.S. academics are full of people with that sort of understanding, far, far deeper than I ever could.
Well, maybe the academics, but we see an isolationist view of the United States right at the moment, especially with Donald Trump's election. Right. And is it possible to have this sort of understanding of China with the mood in the country at this time?
I certainly hope that Donald Trump, and I'm still optimistic. I think Donald Trump, I always tell my family that Donald Trump, deep, deep down, is a businessman. He thinks of anything in business terms. And therefore, if understanding China is good for the business, he'll do it. And also, it's interesting too, people were very concerned, people I know, are concerned with the people that surround him because they tend to be maybe of a more aggressive type. And I said, well, let's think about his experience, his life experience, Trump's life experience. His life experience is that he was a CEO. He founded companies. And as CEO, yes, the vice president may come in with some ideas. He made the decision. Unlike Obama's situation, where probably the Secretary of State sometimes made the decision and Obama would go along with it. And I suspect Trump is the other way around, because that is not his nature as a CEO. The nature of the CEO is, I make the decision. You don't make the decision. And I think that if that's true, and I have no reason to doubt that is true, I hope that he would look at it that way.
Well, you're on a mission then of One Belt, One Road,
right.
Global challenges and opportunities. Those are kind of two different things. And you're traveling all over the world now on this sort of thing, especially through China, I understand. Is that right? And the United States.
And Southeast Asia.
And what are you trying to accomplish?
Oh, I'm trying to accomplish as an individual who is deeply infatuated with the concept. And as an academic, I find it very interesting. Why? Because, well, I was invited last year, last July, by the Singapore friends to speak about One Belt, One Road. And I actually don't know much about One Belt, One Road, so I started to dig into it. And the more I dig into it, the more I was fascinated, in fact, mesmerized by the concept. And I realized also that I had some kind of thinking like this even before this time. I give you a very interesting history. The concept of One Belt, One Road was announced by Xi Jinping in September and October of 2013. He gave two speeches, both in Central Asia. I think it was Kazakhstan, but I could be wrong. It's one of those Stan countries. It could be Tajikistan. I that time was in Taiwan. So I didn't hear about the One Belt, One Road terminology. That December, I was in Taiwan, and there was a very, very important conference held in my university, the Tsinghua University in Taiwan. And what is that? It was a conference where 23 of so-called LERU, L-E-R-U, which stands for League of European Research Universities, include Cambridge, Oxford, all the top universities in Europe, and 17 top universities in Asia Pacific, 6 in Japan, 5 in mainland China, 2 in Taiwan, 1 in Hong Kong, 3 in Korea. All the presidents came under one roof. And my boss said, because I was senior vice president, he said, you give the keynote speech. So I said, uh-oh, what am I going to say to the 40 top educators leading universities in Europe and Asia? So I look at the two sets of universities, and I found that the Western universities were all founded before, during, and slightly after the Renaissance. Okay? 1100 to 1500. They were all formed roughly then, way before the United States. And the Asian universities, the modern form of Asian universities, the oldest one was University of Tokyo, which is 1866 or 70s, something 1800, late 1800s. So there's young kids and old boys. And then I start looking at the map. I look at North America, I say, that's really fascinating. Somehow North America looks like enormous land and gradually almost broken off just before South America. You know, this is very, very narrow, just before it blossoms out into South America. So it is natural to call this a continent. Then you look at South America, it's a continent. You look at Africa, it's a continent. Australia, New Zealand, of course. But Asia Pacific, Asia and Europe, is one piece of land.
Yes.
And again, Dr. Feng, we're ruled by time, and we've run out for this week, but I want to pick up where we left off next week.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
Pick a number. 5 years from now, we could essentially have no power outages on the residential grid. How does that impact your life? If you could ensure that you had a Kroger or a Dairy Queen or the bank that always had energy, how does that improve the productivity? How does it positively impact our customers' lives? Those are the things that we're starting to think about. If you'll let me be a little bit dodgy and tell you the exact timeline I think it's going to happen on, I can't predict, but I do believe that that's the expectation of our customers is we have low cost, reliable energy, and in an effort to enhance reliability, if in fact you could bring a technology like energy storage onto the grid to try and substantially reduce the number of outages, I think that's something that we've got to take real seriously and look to see how would we cost effectively integrate it into the grid. Michael Quinn, Vice President of Corporate Strategy and Chief Technology Officer for Oncor Electric Delivery.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.